Morning. So as the image behind me might suggest, we're not talking about the gospel reading from John this morning, but we're actually going to talk a little bit about the reading from the book of Revelation. And I don't know about you, but when we start to dive into the book of Revelation, just something in me goes, because Revelation is frankly a crazy book. I don't know if you've read it, but if you're in the mood for something wild, have at it. And that's partially because Revelation is a different style of writing from the rest of the New Testament. There are little bits and pieces of this style, but Revelation is the only one that is entirely what we call apocalyptic literature. Now, the word apocalyptic, if you use it just in normal, everyday conversation, one, that's a weird word to use, and two, it does not mean end of the world. Like sometimes we'll say, of apocalyptic proportions, and what we mean is really big and it's going to end all life or something like that. But the word in Greek, apokalypso, just means I uncover. Apocalypse just means an uncovering or revealing, hence revelation. It's like they thought that through. And this style of writing is known in the Jewish world around the first century. We've got multiple examples of this style that honestly read pretty similar, although with some key differences. And it's known for its symbolic language. And notice, although I had a bit of a Freudian slip there, notice it's symbolic, not code. Meaning that almost entirely the book of Revelation is not meant to be decoded. There's no cipher with, like, one exception. I'll talk about that in a second. It is symbolic. Now, the one exception, of course, is when the author says specifically, hey, this takes wisdom, and this is my very terrible translation, you got to think this through, hint, hint, wink, wink, the mark of the beast is 666. Now, that's a pretty famous, that's probably the most famous thing from the book of Revelation. And he's specifically saying, decode it. Now, this is written in Greek, and he's writing to an obviously very Jewish audience because the book of Revelation is like the master class in writing a book that pulls everything from the Hebrew Bible, which is another reason why it might feel very, very unfamiliar. But anyway, if you take the Greek the name Caesar Nero in Greek, turn it into Hebrew, and then each Hebrew letter has a numerical value, you get the number 666. And the reason why we know that this is referring to Nero is that if you take Caesar Nero in Latin and translate, I know this sounds crazy, and translate it to, or like change the letters to Hebrew and then get the numerical value at 616. And that's actually the mark of the beast in the most recent manuscript found in the book of Revelation. It was uncovered in about 2005 in the dig site called Oxyrhynchus in Egypt. Now, why am I saying all of this? To throw you off just a little bit. But it's actually very possible that the number of the beast is 616. We could talk about that sometime or just email me and we can get into it that way. But the book of Revelation for us is supposed to throw you off just a little bit. It's supposed to make you go, wait, so what's actually going on here? Because John, as he is writing this huge revelation, lowercase r, from God, which will become the book of Revelation, capital R, his goal is to encourage the church, which is about to take some really hard hits from the powers that be. And there's a big question about when it was written, because it could be referring to an era under Caesar Nero, who was kind of, he was the first one to make like persecution of Christians a sport, in a sense. Like, he would hold dinner parties, and because human beings have a lot of fat on them, they burn for a long time. So he used Christians as human candles. But it could also be a reference to Caesar Domitian, who was after Nero, but smelled a lot like Nero in his policy toward Christians. Regardless, the message is, hold on. That the turmoil that you experience in life can have meaning in light of what God is doing and in light of what Jesus has done. So the great, you know, wild kind of beastly sort of figures all have like symbolic reference, but the point is that they are all enemies that have been defeated. They just don't know it yet. And so as John is making his way towards the end of the book, we get to probably one of the more important passages in the New Testament. It's kind of the end of all things. But it's not actually the end. It's actually kind of just the beginning. Now, notice the language that he uses. He says, I see a new heaven and a new earth, and the former have passed away. And he uses some very interesting language there that's hard to convey in English. For example, new heavens, new earth. In Greek, there are a couple of ways to say new. There's neos, which just means new. Like, I buy a brand new car. Did not have a car. I give them lots of money after arguing and haggling and them wasting massive amounts of my time. If you're in the car industry, you know what I'm talking about. I don't know where he went. Oh, yes. I pay them lots of money, and then boom, I have a car that I did not have before. But I know there's at least a few of you here that really are into restoring old cars, which I think is really cool. It's something I could never do. And so you could take like an old beat up car that has that's the right model and could be really cool, but it's a little rusted out and it needs a new everything and all of that. And through a long process, you make it new. That's a different kind of new. And in Greek, we would say kainos. And the emphasis there is that it's a refreshing. It's a renewal. It's continuous with what it used to be. So in the car analogy, like the frame is the same and the shape is the same and it has similar capabilities. But it's made new. That's the kind of new that John uses here. The new heavens and the new earth, it does not mean that God said, boom, out, or dynamite, or whatever the divine equivalent of dynamite is, probably lightning, but I don't know. And instead, all right, here, I'm just going to make something new, because in doing that, it would be almost like looking back and saying, that was a mistake. And if we take the operating idea here that fundamentally underlines everything, which is that God transforms even crucifixion into the defeat of death, then he can redeem anything. Then God doesn't make mistakes, but he does redeem suffering. And so this new heavens and this new earth are a renewal. They're a redemption of what came before it. Now imagine you're living in the first century and you receive this crazy letter, although if you're kind of, if you're ethnically Jewish, you would know this. You would know how to read this, and you know that things are about to get really difficult. And maybe you're already feeling the screws tighten. Local authorities are starting to crack down on what is technically an illegal religion. From the top, like the very top, whichever Caesar is in power during this time, is starting to pass down some policies that are going to make life hard. To hear that God has in mind the renewal and redemption of all things. Well, honestly, you can endure a lot if you know that it's going to have meaning. Now, new heavens, new earth, and then he does say the old passes away. But again, there's a meaning there that's hard to convey in English. It's op ilphone. The same word that you'll hear used sometimes when Jesus cures leprosy. Like the leprosy clears away. It passes away. And what emerges is fresh new skin, which, you know, the older I get, the more I could use. But, you know, which again continues this theme that it takes something that has gone really wrong and transforms it into something that is new, in a sense, as it should be. Why, all of this is really good news. And there are some other bizarre but very important things, like as this in our reading was just verses 1 through 7, and then that continues into next week as it goes further. We're not going to talk about it next week, don't worry. But there are some other features that are really important to point out. For example, this new heavens and this new earth. As John is writing this, he makes it clear that there's no need for a temple. And if you are operating within the Jewish world, and the book of Revelation is nothing if not operating within the Jewish world, that would be unthinkable. Because that's the place where you meet God. But it says there's no need for a temple because God and the Son are present. Which is a fulfillment. It's kind of the goal of the entire biblical narrative, that God's presence will return to his people. It started in the Garden of Delight. It made its way through some really, really interesting interactions with Abraham. It definitely came to Mount Sinai with Moses as he gave him the gift of Torah. That was the point of the tabernacle or the great tent. That was absolutely the point of Solomon's temple. And then God's presence departed when God said, okay, enough is enough. You guys keep worshiping other gods. I'm out of here for a while. You're going to have a little break. And then the question had been lingering for a long time. When is God going to return? And it turns out the answer is Jesus. But John envisions a day when Jesus returns off of his throne and he's here with us. Can you imagine? Like Jesus, it's very easy for Jesus to become almost an abstract idea. Like think of the other great people of history. We talk about them and the great things that they did, but it's very abstract. It can become a little bit more concrete if you go maybe visit their grave. But there's still that separation, that distance. And as we talk about Jesus every Sunday every Sunday of the history of our church, it it can start to feel like Jesus is a little bit more abstract, but can you imagine that as John is writing this, he is describing a day when we can say, he's right there. Huh. Now, he will then continue, it wasn't in our reading, to describe some other bizarre things. For example, the New Jerusalem comes. And the New Jerusalem is 12,000 stadia in length, width, and height. That's about 1,400 miles. Can you imagine a 1,400 miles cubed building? It's a perfect cube. I don't know if anybody here likes to build things, but have you ever built a giant, perfect cube? Does it seem bizarre? In the Temple of Solomon, there was one place where essentially nobody went except for once a year. And in Hebrew, it's the Kadosh Kadoshim, the most holy place. That is where the presence of God is. That is his footstool. You do not go in there. And for the one person that does, it's a scary thing and you've got to prepare yourself. But that is likewise a perfect cube. And so this vision, this breaking into our reality that John describes, that is frankly bizarre, but it's not nearly the most bizarre thing in the book of Revelation, is that the end goal is the presence of God. To actually see him. To be near him. To live with him. Now, if you're a very astute listener, you might have noticed some other things. It says there, the sea is no more. Which, taken very literally, means I guess surfers do not go to heaven or something like that. I mean, I used to be one. I don't know. That should tell us right there that something strange is also happening. See, the Israelites were terrified of the sea. They were not seafaring people. And frankly, the sea is terrifying. If you've ever spent any time in the ocean, you know. I've almost drowned surfing at Half Moon Bay in California. And I'm a pretty strong swimmer, and that was something. See, the sea represented chaos. The sea is that thing that even humanity in its modern technological innovation cannot control very easily. I mean, think of like the biggest, craziest, most expensive cruise liner, cruise ship. How many times a year do we hear about something going wrong and one of them getting stuck? Seems like about every year. That's supposed to represent like the best that we've got. And I bring this up because a lot of this is symbolic. It's not 100% clear how this will all play out. Except what we do know is that in the end of all things, the culmination of all things, the fulfillment of all things, when history as we know it comes to an end, the heavens and the earth are renewed, refreshed, in a way that is continuous with what came before. Which I find very encouraging. Because think about the mess that is life. I don't know anybody here, and I know a lot of you, most of you, that doesn't have something, at least something in their lives, whether recent or a long time ago, where they just go, oh, this was a mess. This was hard, this nearly crushed me, and I can't make sense of it. If God just dynamited everything and said, we're going to start over, it would be as if he's saying, I'm just going to dismiss that. Let's pretend it never happened. And that is the worst, most unhelpful thing you can do for suffering. The way you heal suffering is not by imagining it didn't happen, but by passing through it and finding its redemption. And so what starts out as highly symbolic, frankly kind of crazy, revelatory, apocalyptic writing about some kind of new heavens, new earth, something or other, the dwelling place of God is with humanity, there's no need for a temple, and all of that kind of thing is all a promise that there will come a moment when we look back and say, oh, this is what God has been doing this whole time. It also means that heaven, as human beings, is not our home. Notice that this isn't us going up to heaven. Now, to be fair, I'm not saying heaven isn't real or we don't go to heaven when we die or something like that. But what I am saying is that there's more to that story. Because a human beings were literally made to live on earth. And there is some kind of like interim, like we will be with Jesus, which is in heaven in some form or fashion. But the New Testament doesn't care that much about it. What it cares about is not life after death, but life after death, which is the new heavens and the new earth and us returning to our home as it should be. And that leaves open a lot of questions. What does that look like? How old will my body be? Because I'm hoping for like 19. I think I peaked when I was 19. Please not in my 40s, because everything's starting to hurt. Leaves open all kinds of questions. But if creation itself will be resurrected and renewed, including our bodies which were redeemed by Jesus himself, this moment that John describes is the end of the previous story. And I don't know what that might mean for all of you. I can guess for some of you. But those hard moments, those moments of our own making, the ways that our brokenness have affected ourselves and those around us, all of those stories come to an end. And we look back, and we think, that was a good story. It's kind of this known thing, and I'll end with this, in modern storytelling, like even movies. The story of a character's fall is never as good as the story of that character's redemption. And God is a really good storyteller. And so with that book shut, the picture that John paints of this new heavens and new earth is then the opening of a new book. What that story looks like, I have no idea. What is involved in that story? No clue. The only thing we know is that Jesus will be there with us, present. Physically, bodily. And I'm willing to bet it will be just as good. Amen. As you are able, please rise.